Janelle is a recent graduate of Tyndale. She did an excellent master's thesis on the topic she's going to talk about, open theism and theodicy. And, you know, you may be aware within the Wesleyan Arminian community, I mean, Wesleyan Arminian theology classically is not open theism, right? This not, we're not open theist in general. But there are some Wesleyans who are sympathetic, and some Arminians who are sympathetic to openness theology, open theism. And so it's an interesting question for our community. So I want to thank Janelle for bringing it to our attention.
So I brought a handout because I think it kind of helps follow the order of my presentation. It's two sides.
Sure. Great. Open towards the door. There's a bathroom. Yeah. And the back door, I think, does open to it if anyone wants to sneak in. It's called crossover. Yeah, come on in. You're right on time.
So my name is Janelle Zeeb. I'm a recent graduate from Tyndale with my Master of Theological Studies. I graduated in November. And I'm very happy to be here and to be able to share with you this presentation, which is based on part of my thesis. So as you've got the handout, it's double-sided. It kind of follows the order of my presentation. So I hope it's relatively clear. So I've titled this presentation, Comparing Arminianism and Open Theism on Theodicy, an example of how experience affects our preferences for theological systems. So while we might think that which theological system, such as Calvinism, Arminianism, or open theism, that we choose to align ourselves with should be based primarily on biblical exegesis and systematic theology, in reality it is much more complex. In this presentation, I will show that our personal experiences, beliefs, and preferences also affect which theological system we are most drawn to. This will be done by comparing the differences between Arminian and open theist approaches to theodicy, and showing what factors influence which system is more personally convincing. Theodicy in particular is a good example to use to compare theological systems, as theodicy can be argued to be one of the most important aspects of any theological system, and it is also one of the most practically relevant. I'm sure all of us have wondered about God's relationship to the evil and suffering in our lives. In fact, theodicy is possibly the area where our experience most directly influences our theology, as theodicy attempts to explain our experiences of evil and reconcile them with our faith in a good and loving God. So since each of us experiences different instances of evil and suffering in our lives, It makes sense that we will all approach the Odyssey from our own personal perspective, with our own sufferings most prominently in mind. And as we will see, our view of the Odyssey will influence our view of God. So there are many similarities between open theism and Arminianism. So both Arminians and open theists agree that God can only act according to his nature, which is love, and thus God can never do evil or will evil. Both also make use of the free will defense for theodicy, which explains evil as a misuse of God-given creaturely free will. However, due to differing definitions of God's omniscience, there are significant differences in their implications for theodicy. I will focus on three main areas where the differences between Arminian and open theist approaches to theodicy are the most distinct. However, before we can discuss this, we have to deal with a somewhat abstract philosophical topic, so please bear with me for now. So the main issue that divides Arminians and open theists is on the issue of how God's foreknowledge relates to human freedom. Arminians say that God foreknows what we will freely do, but this does not force us to act in ways that God foreknows. But open theists disagree and believe that if the future is foreknown by God, then the future is fixed and we have no real freedom to change it. Ultimately, it's impossible to know who is right, and here is where our own philosophical beliefs can affect which theological system appears most credible to us. On the Arminian side, it makes sense that we are still free, even though God foreknows what we will do, simply because we do not yet know what we will do. So when making any choice, it's free from our perspective because we do not know the future. So for example, let's say that God foreknows I will eat spaghetti for dinner tonight. When I'm in the kitchen choosing what to eat, I do not know that God knows I will eat spaghetti, and God is not forcing me to eat spaghetti, and so my choice does seem to be free, as Arminians say, even though God foreknows it. In fact, if I had chosen soup instead, God's foreknowledge would have been different, and he would have eternally foreknown that I would eat soup. But then let's think about another example. Let's say that God perfectly foreknows that I will be in a car accident next week. Since it's perfectly foreknown by God, and nothing can alter his knowledge, then nothing I do between now and then can prevent me from being in that car accident exactly as God foreknows. So I can't take a different route, or take public transit instead, or I would be changing the content of God's foreknowledge. Even prayers for God to protect me while driving could not change the future that God foreknows. And so from this perspective, it does seem that if God foreknows something, then the future is unchangeable. So therefore, open theists say that in order for humans to have real freedom and significant choices, God cannot foreknow what we will choose. At first glance, this would seem to be an unbiblical idea, and so to reassure you that it's not heretical, please let me give a short overview of how open theists understand God's omniscience and omnipotence. So open theists say that God's omniscience means that God knows everything that any being can know. He knows everything that's ever existed, everything that now actually exists, everything that could possibly exist in the future, and everything that he has decided to do. However, because of the conviction that God's foreknowledge of a future choice would remove our freedom, open theists believe that in order to preserve real human freedom, God either willingly limits his own knowledge of the future, or else perhaps the nature of the future is such that there are some things even God can't know for certain. This is kind of similar to the commonly accepted idea that there are some things that even God can't do, such as make a square circle. But this doesn't mean that God loses all providential control, because God still knows a huge amount of information. He knows the present and past perfectly. He knows things that do not depend on free choice. He knows our hearts completely. And God knows what options are open to us, and even how likely we may be to choose one option over the other. So if you take the previous example about choosing what to have for dinner, God can know that there's like a 70% chance that I'll have spaghetti, and a 30% chance that I will choose soup. But open theists would say that God couldn't know for sure which one I would choose. And then regarding omnipotence, open theists say that God's omnipotence does not mean that he controls everything. Instead, it means that God is so resourceful, flexible, and intelligent that he can achieve his purposes in a variety of ways. So God can work around any good or bad choices we make, and he can even work around those who directly oppose him in order to ensure that his ultimate goals are never defeated. Therefore, to open theists, God does not need perfect foreknowledge in order to still achieve his purposes. And by now you're probably wondering about how open theism handles biblical prophecy, and I'll get to that in a few minutes. So, you can flip your hand over right at this point. So now, while this may seem to be simply an interesting abstract debate, it actually has important implications for how we understand God's relationship to evil. which then has practical consequences for how we face evil in our lives. Depending on our opinion of these philosophical questions, we might be inclined more towards Arminianism or open theism. If one believes that God's foreknowledge of the future does indeed mean it is fixed and unchangeable, it would seem that the open theist approach may offer more motivation to oppose evil than the Arminian one. If we believe that we can actually change the future because it is not set in stone, due to God's perfect foreknowledge of it, it can encourage us to do what we can to oppose evil and relieve suffering now. Also, we can believe that we are not doomed to experience any particular occasion of evil simply because God foreknows it will occur, such as the car accident example I mentioned earlier. So the open theist view may also help encourage us that our futures are not predetermined by God's foreknowledge, which means we can change ourselves and the world around us for the better. This can be a very encouraging outlook on the world. So on the contrary, to preserve motivation to oppose evil, an Arminian would have to hold tightly to the conviction that God's knowing of the future does not remove our freedom and responsibility to work against evil. If they were ever tempted to think that because God foreknows something that it's unavoidable, or that God has pre-planned evil or allowed evil for some greater good, it could easily lead to apathy or complacency to work against evil. So therefore, depending on one's thought process and philosophical beliefs, open theism could possibly provide more motivation to oppose evil than the Arminian approach does. There's another difficulty an Arminian may have with respect to theodicy, which is the problem of foreknowing evil. So this comes from looking back at evil events that occurred in history. For example, if God perfectly foreknew what Hitler would do, he had created him anyway, then does that mean that God is guilty for unleashing such a person on the world? Or did God know it was better to allow Hitler's actions than to not allow them? Thus, Arminians must find ways to justify why God allows the evil that he foreknows will occur. But open theists have a similar problem. Instead of having to justify why God allows evil that he foreknows will occur, open theists must explain why God allows evil that he is quite certain will occur based on his present knowledge. So for example, even if God did not foreknow what Hitler would do, once God knew Hitler's evil intentions and saw the evil that he had already done, then why did God continue to let Hitler live? Or regarding the events of September 11th, God would have known the plans of the terrorists and would have seen them carrying out each step, yet seemingly did nothing to stop them. To answer these problems, both Arminians and open theists can appeal to God's respect for human freedom. Both could argue that God does not prevent more evil because if he did prevent, say, the worst evils, then because they didn't happen, we would not be aware of them. Then we would demand that God prevent the next worst evils, which we do see occurring, and this would continue in a cycle until we would demand that God prevent all evil in the world. Yet this would mean that God would have to override all free will. So if God desires that we exercise free will to love and obey him, then he must accept that since we are free, we will not always use our free will in the way he wants. And in order to honor the freedom he has given us, he must not override the evil that results from the misuse of free will. Both Arminians and open theists could agree with Clark Pinnock, who wrote, "God is moved by love to restrain the divine power, temporarily and voluntarily, out of respect for the integrity of creatures, even creatures whose activities fall short of God's purposes." However, there may be one case where open theism has an advantage, as illustrated by the story of Suzanne, as told by her pastor, Gregory Boyd. So Suzanne wanted to be a missionary to Taiwan, and she had prayed that God would guide her to the right man to marry who would have a similar heart for missions. In college, she met a man who had the same goals as she did, and who was compatible with her in many other areas, so she felt it must have been divine providence that they had met. But Suzanne wanted confirmation from God that this was indeed the man she should marry. She prayed intensely, and finally believed that she had received this confirmation. Yet she was devastated 2 years later when she found out her husband had committed adultery. He appeared to repent, yet cheated on her several more times. He lost his desire for missions to Taiwan and became physically and emotionally abusive. Finally, he filed for divorce and moved out, and just 2 weeks later, Suzanne found out she was pregnant. So Suzanne was angry at God because if God knew exactly what her husband would do, then God bears all the responsibility for setting her up the way he did. This situation could be hard for an Arminian to explain to Suzanne. Why would God tell her to marry a man who God perfectly foreknew would hurt her in such a deep way? Should we appeal to the common explanations that maybe God has a greater good purpose for her suffering? Or maybe he was trying to teach her something? Or maybe she did not hear God's guidance correctly? Or something else? Or is it easier to say, as her open theist pastor Gregory Boyd did, that maybe God did not know how Suzanne's husband would misuse his free will to hurt her? Boyd suggested that initially God believed that Suzanne marrying her husband would have a high chance of having a happy marriage and fulfilling ministry. But when her husband decided to misuse his free will to commit adultery, it led to him becoming a different person than who he was when God had recommended that Suzanne marry him. So this explanation comforted Suzanne, helped her love God again, and retained her faith in being able to hear God's guidance. So open theists have an advantage over Arminians here, because they do not have to believe that God may guide us into situations where he perfectly foreknows we will experience evil. In response, there's two main objections to the open theist idea that God does not know what evil may happen to us in the future. The first objection is that if there really is evil that God did not foreknow and is not part of God's plan, then does it mean the evil we experience has no purpose? Often those who make this objection fear that removing the sense of purpose behind evil, pain, or suffering will remove the ability to endure it. Yet open theists reply that because God's omnipotence means he is very resourceful, flexible, and intelligent, we can still trust that God can bring some good out of the evil we experience, even if the evil was not intended for good, and even if God did not foreknow the evil would happen. It may even be that God is so capable of recovering good out of unforeseen evil that it might appear to us as if his backup plan was his original plan. The second objection is that if God does not foreknow the evil that will happen to us, then how can he give us useful guidance to avoid it? Open theists can reply that God's present knowledge is so complete and God's wisdom is so great that in most cases, perfect knowledge of the future is not necessary to give helpful guidance. For long-term guidance, such as who to marry or which career to choose, open theists say that while God does care about these things, he does not have one set plan for our lives. Instead, what matters most to God is that we are conformed to the image of Christ, and this can happen in a variety of careers or with a variety of marriage partners. So there might not be one set plan for our lives, but many different good paths that we can choose, and God can work out his plan for us in many different ways. So as we've seen, the story of Suzanne can show that to some people, it's more comforting to believe that God did not knowingly guide them down a path that guaranteed they would experience evil and suffering, even if it means accepting a different perspective on God's omniscience and guidance. Others who are drawn to Arminianism might find more comfort in the belief that God knows exactly how their lives will unfold, and trust that God's foreknowledge means he has planned for good to come out of any of the evil that they experience along the way. Some people might find the idea that God does not have one set plan for their lives liberating, while others might find it terrifying. And like Suzanne, we may even change our views if something happens to us, which is significant enough to make us question our previous convictions. Therefore, our personal perspectives on philosophy and theology and our personal experiences can certainly affect which theological system we are drawn to, and these factors can change over time. However, I do think at this point in time, there is one clear advantage for Arminianism in relation to theodicy, and that is regarding the problem of prophesied evil. So open theists say that God can predict things that are likely to happen on the basis of his perfect present knowledge, and God can predict things that he plans to do in a specific circumstance. So while this approach may work for a large number of prophecies, there are still a few specific cases that are troubling, particularly the cases where God prophesies very specific evil events. I have not yet read a convincing open theist approach to how God is able to prophesy Judas's betrayal of Jesus, or Peter's three denials of Jesus before dawn, or even the crucifixion of Jesus on the exact right date of Passover. We can't say that God caused Judas to betray Jesus, or made Peter deny Christ in order to fulfill prophecy, or we would be taking away Judas and Peter's personal responsibility for their behavior and making God responsible for evil. So while God could have known that Judas was considering betraying Jesus, open theists can't say that God perfectly foreknew he would actually go through with it. If Judas had freely chosen not to betray Jesus, then God would have needed some other way for Jesus to be delivered to the Sanhedrin. And while God might have known that at that particular moment in time, Peter had the sort of character which made him likely to deny Jesus if he were pressured, it would have required God to coordinate all the circumstances Peter was in that night in order to make sure he was asked by the right people at the right times to make it all happen. And what if Peter freely decided to go home and sleep after the first denial? So a similar level of complicated divine coordination of people's evil actions would have been needed to ensure that Jesus would be crucified on the exact right date, not a week earlier or a few days later, in order to fulfill the Passover foreshadowing from the Old Testament. So these are the sorts of complicated explanations that open theists need to have in order to explain these very specific prophecies. but at this point it seems like it's much easier to take the Arminian approach and say that God can prophesy about evil actions simply because he foreknows them, which means that God does not have to have any involvement in coordinating evil events in order to make them happen as prophesied. So therefore, if someone desires to have a more straightforward explanation for biblical prophecy, which keeps God from being involved in any coordination of evil events, perhaps Arminianism is more attractive. Yet if someone can tolerate a little mystery surrounding how difficult biblical prophecies work, perhaps open theism may be an option. This shows how there are many factors that are at work in our choice of theological system, and there are trade-offs no matter which system we choose. So in conclusion, I hope this analysis has shown that our personal experiences and philosophical beliefs have a significant influence on which theological system we choose to align ourselves with. In particular, our experiences of evil can have a powerful effect on our belief system, which may cause some to hold even more tightly to their previous beliefs, while others may find that, like Suzanne, switching theological systems can provide answers they need to continue loving God. There is a level of faith required in all cases. An open theist may need to have faith that Bible prophecy is true and accurate, even if it's not yet fully explainable by open theism, and also have faith that God can still achieve his purposes and provide guidance to us, even without fully knowing the future. An Arminian will need to have faith that there is some reason why God allows all the evil that he foreknows, and that despite God knowing the future, we are still responsible to do what we can now to oppose evil. So there are trade-offs in every theological system that must be weighed by the individual. Depending on their own beliefs, needs, and priorities, each person may come to different conclusions on which trade-offs are acceptable to them. Perhaps this is why multiple theological systems exist, despite having only one Bible. Despite some critics who argue that there is only one right system and label anyone who disagrees with them a heretic, this shows how theological diversity is valuable in the church. Because at this time we all see in a dim and partial way, our experiences and personal beliefs are currently an important factor in helping us make sense of faith right now, until the day when we all see clearly. So therefore, because we're all different and have different experiences that influence our theological understanding, theological diversity among Christians is necessary in order to help as many people as possible find a place in a church which can encourage their faith, help them love God, comfort them in difficult times, and keep pointing them to Christ. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Janelle. In case you didn't catch it, that's her first time doing an academic paper, so please encourage her, and we're glad that you did a wonderful job in really helping us to relate it to life and ministry and things we can all relate to. So, and I should have mentioned also that Janelle's been accepted into the PhD program at Wycliffe College. In the fall, where she's going to be working on Jonathan Edwards and Theodicy. So, glad she'll continue that work. But questions, comments, responses?
Yes.
I've worked in mission work to African countries, and there are non-Christian beliefs, for instance, fatalism, determinism, or many. This expression we often hear, it must have happened for a reason. Or the soldier that says there's a bullet out there with my name on it. Well, these are from secular sources. The person that has that view has to identify with one of these theological positions. For some, I guess it's comforting to know that, well, something has been predetermined and I can't do anything to change it, so life goes on. Now, how to convey these thoughts to a congregation, for instance, of people who grew up in a culture of fatalism, is a huge challenge.
I guess that's sort of what I ran across when I was doing my thesis. I was comparing Calvinism mostly with open theism, and Calvinists can be very deterministic to the point of saying that everything that happens is what God wants to happen. But I think probably the clearest rebuttal to that idea is that, well, does God want sin? And some of them maybe go so far as to say that, yes, God does want sin for some obscure reason to show his glory and his wrath at sin and all that sort of thing. So I think it's much clearer to say that God doesn't want sin. So therefore, if God, something happens that God doesn't want, clearly not everything is caused by God. And so there's other factors, there must be other factors going on, especially once we include the idea of spiritual warfare. This can also prevent the idea of fatalism. We can say that there are other forces at play in this world besides just what God wants. So there's a bunch of different ideas, but I also ran across a story of John Piper, who talked about his experience when his mom died in a car crash. And to him, he said that he could not worship a God who can't control like a piece of lumber which came through the van and killed his mom. So to him, he had to believe that God had caused her death for a greater purpose, and that's the only way he could continue loving God and worshiping God. So it really shows that how people react to evil and suffering is really in a bunch of different ways. And to some people, it really does comfort them to think that, okay, God knew this was happening, God caused this to happen, and he's doing it for some reason. So everyone's different. Yes?
Have you read Tom Orr's new book, The Uncontrolling Love of God?
Not yet. I've read a couple reviews about it. One which kind of was negative about it and called him kind of close to a process theist. And then another one which kind of was more positive and saying that no, he's really not a process theist. He's just expressing his own ideas of kind of an open theist view of God.
It's an open theism based on the idea that God's essential nature is love, and therefore love is never controlling. So God cannot be controlling, and so he can't prevent evil because he actually has no control over it because of his essential nature, which is love. And so it's a way of getting God off the hook for evil. But I'd be interested sometime to hear your thoughts on that. Mm-hmm. Good chance to read it.
Yeah, I mean, just based on what you said there, I think that maybe that goes a little bit too far. I think we should say that God can prevent some evil, and he can override some evils, which we obviously are not aware of because he's prevented them. But we'd say that in general, he doesn't override evil because he respects freedom. So there must be some evils which God realizes are serious enough that he must override, otherwise the human race might come to not exist anymore, such as the threat of nuclear war or all sorts of spread of disease or stuff like this. I think God has control over these things in order to keep us alive and on this planet. Once you add the idea of spiritual warfare, that God is countering constantly what the opposing forces are trying to do. So I don't think it's the case that God can't control evil because he's love. I think it's just there's a certain limit that in general he doesn't prevent smaller incidences of evil because of our freedom and everything. But I think he does prevent big instances of evil because he'd have to keep us all alive.
Well, it's worth you engaging with because Ward would say you have a logical inconsistency because God will prevent the murder of one person but allow a Holocaust to occur.
Uh-huh.
And if you want to just flip to the positive, he heals someone, lets many, many other die.
Uh-huh.
And so it's back and forth, and God seems very capricious. So that's his way of engaging that. So that might be useful for you to do more work in this.
There's a very couple interesting books. Have you read God at War by Gregory Boyd or Satan and the Problem of Evil? Where Boyd has a very interesting idea that God gives different amounts of freedom to different creatures, and depending on how these creatures use their freedom, they can cause more or less evil, depending on what they're doing, and depending on how many people decide to align themselves with evil, God is going to have a more difficult time countering those than countering incidences where there's less opposition, less people throwing their free will kind of behind that. So I think that's probably a promising way to go. And in some sense, I think I have an idea I'm starting to work on that. That might be a solution to the biblical prophecy of evil events from an open theist perspective, and I hope to eventually write a book on that.
Within the academic community, is open theism seen as an evangelical theology?
I think it depends on which evangelicals you talk to.
I asked the question.
But I know I get Clark Kinnock and Gregory Boyd, who are both the most vocal advocates of open theism that I've run across at this point, also John Sanders. They all come across as very evangelical. And so I think it just depends on it being more more well-known in the evangelical community. Lots of people don't know what open theism is. When I first heard about it, the idea that God doesn't know the future, I'm like, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. I can't believe that. The Bible says otherwise. But once you really get into the details of understanding how open theism works, it becomes much more credible.
There was an association of evangelicals put them on trial for that.
Uh-huh, yes, uh-huh. They tried to kick, or there was a move, right, to kick Pinnock out of the Evangelical Theological Society. Uh-huh. But it didn't happen. So
he just doesn't come, I guess.
He's dead. He's dead. He's not. He might be there.
Do you have a question?
In any of your readings, did you find that some of the, just because you mentioned evangelical, did you find any indication that some of the evangelical response to open theism comes from our lack of comfort with mystery? I mean, you mentioned mystery at one point during your talk, and certainly your talk this morning asking that giant question, what are you afraid of? I wonder if that question is asked at all about open theism from an evangelical perspective across that.
Like, I think there's a level of mystery in all of our beliefs, like all theological systems. Like the Calvinists often have to appeal to the mystery of why God ordains things that are evil. And they just say, oh, we don't know, it's a mystery, maybe we'll know in heaven. And like for the open theist, the mystery is how do we deal with difficult biblical prophecies. And Arminians is, well, why does God allow evil that he foreknows will happen? So I think there's just different mysteries. And depending on which one you're willing to live with, kind of guides you toward which system you find more acceptable.
A pertinent passage, Genesis 6:6, the Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth. How we deal with that passage?
Yeah, that's one of the big ones that open theists appeal to the idea that God can change his mind, and he can work in different ways with humanity. So he thought this was going to be a good way. And then everyone turned evil. So he's like, okay, I have to deal with this. How am I going to deal with this? Saves Noah and continues on in an alternate path, but one which still progresses the story towards the fulfillment of his ultimate purposes of having a people who love him and live in relationship with him forever. But yeah, it's fascinating. Do we have time for more?
Yeah, we still have time.
Okay.
You probably know this. Did you know that I'm going to get killed because I'm a Free Methodist, but I work for Hamilton Health Science. No. Did you know that the Free Methodist Church in Canada on its website does have a statement about open theism that neither says, oh, we believe everything they believe, but expresses some sympathy, is open to mystery, and talks about the things you're trying to hold together. Do you know that's there?
No,
you see
I didn't know that. I'll
take a look. Just Google FMCIC. Open theism, and you'll see the denomination statement. There's also a paper from the U.S. denomination by David Bauer, who's a highly credible biblical scholar, with their study commission's take on it. And there's a sense of Free Methodists or Arminians have some sympathy towards the non-hyper-Calvinism of open theists. But we don't say we buy it all, and commend it as something to be wrestled with, and list people who I think it's a doctrine from hell, list those kinds of citations as well as those who are even more positive on it than some of us would be. But yeah, the Free Methodists among us have wrestled with that.
And there is a wide divergence within Free Methodists on it, even if it's on the website.
I think you make a valid point that the personal experiences of individuals tends to tip one in one theological direction or another. And I think that relates to the first presentation very much, that we tend to think that doing theology is all about getting systematic and making it all fit and all that. But the system we tend to relate to has to also be a place where we fit and find comfort and find the love of God and all that. Like you mentioned, I think you make a very good point there.
Oh, thanks.
I think we have to go deeper on this central question here of why people choose theological systems. I don't think this is limited to this is why people are atheists, this is why people are agnostic. I think this basis of experience is actually something we have in common with our neighbors. We, some of us do, some of us don't believe that theology has anything to do with experience, and that we just read the Bible and do what it says. But for those of us that believe that experience plays a role, I think this is actually like a key bridge building point to engaging all of our neighbors in conversation. So I want to encourage you, the central question you ask, I think is really important. This is a contrast and compare Arminian versus...
Yeah, and this is just one example of how an experience affects our preferences in this very narrow condition. I'm sure there's all sorts of other ways that our experience at large will affect our Arminians on all sorts of other theological topics. And like you said, whether someone even believes or doesn't believe, experience will probably affect that. Like, I've heard all sorts of stories of people who say, oh, I went to a church and they didn't like me and they were unwelcoming, so I don't want to be a part of that. And even those sorts of experiences can really push someone one way or another.
I think there's some sociological research in the United States around authoritarians that, you know, they're saying they have an explanation as to the rise of Donald Trump beyond the power of his haircut. But it's, they say that there's a pre-existing sort of psychological condition or kinds of needs that lead to sort of authoritarian approaches to government, and that even these traits are not activated until certain conditions. So I'm curious about, I think there's at least a corollary there between the central question you're asking, and I think it's a good line still. So I encourage you.
Jason, oh. You started earlier and you said you define, I think you defined evil a little bit. But I see on your handout you have God will never will or do evil. Evil results from misuse of God's given free will. So do you have more of a, on evil, you know, like people differentiate sin as actions, sin as a condition, natural evils, you know, there's a deep analysis of evil in a sense and how it relates, like, evil in an Augustinian sense, maybe of, you know, imperfection. And so even when we're, I just was asking for more naming or explanation on how we take evil, because that even will have a difference on the issue.
Yeah, I guess when I was working on this paper and on my thesis, I would consider evil to be anything that is not what God wants for the world. So that would include sin, that would include natural evil, that would include moral evil, that would include our sinful natures, although the sinful nature is what leads to us doing evil actions in the world. So it's really a huge category of things. And basically, if we think of life now and what life might be in heaven, based on a couple books that I've read and stuff like that, anything that will not be in heaven, I would pass as evil, basically.
Will dogs be?
Depends if you're a dog person or a cat person.
It's my experience.
Yeah. Thank you, Janelle. Great job again.